intensity, sweetest romance? Paris, the rooftop, Washington Square Park? Were they all repeat performances, his attempt to revive Tara, relive his past? I'd venture yes, by the way his eyes cloud and narrow and he's studying me, torn between his logic and his base-level desires. His face softens, loses an edge. He shakes his head, says nothing. I continue. Paris? Our honeymoon? And here, he breaks a bit. I can see it. His eyes widen and his jaw slacks. Henry is a rational man, but he wants this. Most people forgo logic when faced with something impossible that they viscerally want. Let's go to Paris, again. You and me. We'll relive it again. This time, for real. Hal and TJ. I choke out, lower my voice, dip my chin to my chest and whisper, "You can help me, Hal. Show me how to act, I mean. All I've ever wanted is for you to take care of me." I realize with a sickening jolt that it's actually true. He doesn't speak, he simply backs out of the room, his hand clutched tight around the syringe. His knuckles and his face an identical shade of white. He doesn't agree. Yet. But he will. At the very least, I'm here, still chained but clear-headed. All I have to do is wait. Hal? Hal. I shake him, gently. It's midnight, or later, I can't tell. I have to go. He mumbles something against the pillow. He hasn't drugged me in a whole 24 hours. He avoids me, and this is either very good or very bad. He's considering my offer. He hasn't talked to me, but I chatter at him, rattling off every little thing I can think of that I saw in his boxes, on his corkboard. I talk about our wedding, my plate of scallops, the ornate centerpieces, how it was all just for us, which was the most romantic thing I'd ever seen. I pretend to swoon, and I'm girly, excited even. We could reenact it, renew our vows in Paris. He pretends to ignore me. It's brass tacks time. I blather about whatever comes to mind, about all the things I might have said if I had been myself, but completely and totally under his thumb, meek and in love with him. It's not even hard, like my brain has blocked out the mental images that should come naturally. Remember that day on the boat? I vaguely remember a boat. I don't even know if Tara was on it. He has yet to speak. I'm becoming one person in his mind. I can feel it in the way he looks at me when I say certain things, and he's not sure, Tara or Zoe? Or, rather, even if he knows that we can't possibly be the same person, he sees the possibility exist for the first time. That I could pretend this and stay. That maybe if I did that, became his preferred reality, we could be happy the way he and Tara were happy. I see him doubt his own sanity. But sometimes I see the way he draws a breath, quick and sharp, and I know my wildly flung guesses are occasionally hitting bullseyes. I just have to throw out enough of them. I nudge him with my unchained hand. Hal, please, I don't want to wet the bed again. Remember how mad you were? I try not to remind him of Zoe, only Tara. I try to morph into her, but biology trumps psychology. I have to go to the bathroom. He staggers up, grabs a key off the dresser, and without a word, unlocks me. He studies me as I use the toilet, and I even find myself wondering if Tara would do this way. I wash my hands. He clears his throat in the doorway, the bathroom low-lit with the vanity bulb. On the vanity sits a wide, flat candle. I slather the soap between my fingers and stare at it. It has 3 wicks. 5 pounds? Maybe 2? I don't have a plan, I just have the vague formation of a plan. I dry my hands completely, I don't want them wet slick. I glance at Henry, who is studying the handcuff key, waiting in his boxer shorts. He glances back toward the bedroom. I pick the candle up over my head and bring it down fast and hard right on Henry's forehead. The edge hits the bridge of his nose and blood explodes everywhere. I think he screams. I don't wait to see if he's conscious or knocked out. I just run. I'm out the front door and pounding across the lawn. The woods slap at my arms, my legs, my stomach. My stomach is bare. I'm in Henry's t-shirt and women's underpants that are falling down my hips. The branches scratch my face, but I run. I'm faster than Henry, who runs 5 miles a day. I'm weak and small now, winded, out of breath, but I'm still fast. I cut a zigzag off the path and run in what feels like circles, and the rocks dig at my heels. I'm barefoot, and when I look down, my legs and my feet are bleeding. My hands are covered in blood that might be mine or Henry's. I can't tell if he's behind me. I can't hear anything over the huff of my breath. My lungs burn and my stomach aches, a cramp pulling at my hip. I step on a rock and I feel it break the skin right in the bottom of my foot at the arch. I don't scream. I don't stop. In the distance, there's a light. A soft beacon. A house. A tiny clapboard Cape Cod. A nightlight shining in the window. I don't know if it's empty or if everyone is sleeping. I risk a look behind me, nothing but inky blackness. I stumble up the porch and fall, hitting my face on the step. Pain shoots up my nose, and when I put my hand over it, it comes away bloody. More blood. God, so much blood. I pound on the door, and finally I scream, "Help me! Please open the door! God, open the door!" I'm crying, the snot and the blood and the tears all mixing together in my mouth, and it tastes like salt and metal. I pound harder. "Please answer the door. Please, 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 please." The door flings open. Bare, red-painted toenails, gray hair pulled back in a bun, her mouth open in an O, small and petite, her eyes wide with terror. "Penny." She pulls me inside, deadbolts the door. "Call the police," I say, blubbering, still crying. She wipes my face, my hands with a towel, and can't stop murmuring, "Oh my God, oh my God." When she picks up the landline, it's dead. Her cell phone has no service. "We have to leave. He's coming after us." "Who?" she whispers, her face chalky. "Henry. He's trying to kill me. Just, please, we have to go. Get your car." I pull at her sleeve, her arm, panicked and wild, checking out the front window. He won't announce his arrival. He'll be armed. I say all this.
"I can't leave, Zoe. Frank is upstairs."
Her face is horrified.
"Who's Frank?" "He's my husband. He's quadriplegic. I can't leave him. Take my keys. Go. Get help."
Her eyes dart from the front porch and back to the stairs and back. I take the keys from her.
"I have a gun," she says.
Right as she says this, the front window cracks. Spider webs, the glass implodes, and instinctively, I duck down. I hear Penny scamper behind me, across the hardwood floor and into the kitchen. She leaves me here. Henry stands on the porch, framed by the hole in the glass.
"You think I'm stupid, Zoe?"
"Henry, you can't fix this now. You can't kill us all. Just put the gun down."
I'm calm now. I'm not crying. I can't do anything else. This will be how it all ends, with Henry and a gun and me in my underwear pretending to be my dead twin sister. This is how I will die. The crack behind me barely registers before Henry falls, thrown backward, his toes pointed up almost comically before settling back down to the earth. I smell the gunpowder and the blood before I see anything. Penny stands, framed in the doorway between the living room and the kitchen, holding a shotgun up on her shoulder. A hunter. Everyone hunts. When it falls to her side, her face looks blank, unlined and white with shock. She trembles. On the porch, Henry's leg twitches, just once, like one of his dying deer.
"Now, Zoe, go get help. Now."
Chapter 27. A steady beep, beep pulls me from sleep, heavy and dragging. I want to sleep. I'm so tired. The dark is comforting, a warm electric blanket that I want to burrow under. But instead, my eyes twitch under bright lights. Someone stage whispers, "She's waking up. Hurry!" There is a commotion, a rustling of arms and legs, and I blink. A face appears. A nurse, round and pink, the kind of no-nonsense demeanor others might call plucky. She chatters on, telling me it's Tuesday, that I slept through Monday. I want to speak, but there is an oxygen mask over my mouth. I tug at it. My arms are connected to tubes and wires, the whoosh, hiss, and muffled bleeding of hospital sounds. Machines for monitoring heartbeats and blood pressure. I wonder what the side effects of my drug use will be. She moves the bed to sitting position and takes the mask off my face. She asks me questions I know the answers to, my name, my age, and she bubbles up. "Oh, you've passed." I look around the room, which is empty save for a chair at the foot of the bed. Cash is leaning forward, watching, waiting. When I meet his eyes, he smiles grandly and waves his arms around like a game show host. "Look at all this." I smile weakly back. "Why are you here?" The question comes out unintentionally rude, and I flush. He shrugs. "I was frantic. I can't even tell you, Zoe. I knew something was wrong when you wouldn't take my calls, answer any of my texts. I called Yates. We'd been looking for you."
How long was I don't know how to finish the sentence. Missing?
2 weeks.
2 weeks? It's unfathomable. I close my eyes. White negligee, Henry's hands. My eyes fly open and I grip the nurse's arm. "I need a rape kit," I rasp urgently. She leans forward, smelling like lavender. "It's been done, sweetheart. It was negative."
Thank God. I fall back against the pillow. "Henry is dead," I whisper. It's not a question. I think of his leg, Penny with that gun.
"Yes," Cash says softly, almost reverently.
"Penny saved me," I murmur.
"Yes," Cash agrees.
"I want to see her. Can I see her?"
I struggle to sit up, pinned down by the needles and the tubes. A little pinch. My forehead sweats. I want to cry. I'm so relieved.
"I'll find her. You can't go anywhere. Yates is on her way."
God, 2 weeks. It's all I can think of to say.
"We were going crazy, Zoe. Yates couldn't find you. Henry said you left him. It wasn't until I uncovered who Joni was married to that Yates agreed to fill out a missing persons report. She was this close to applying for a search warrant. I thought he was going to kill you."
"You knew that Joni was Tara?"
I'm incredulous.
"We just put it all together yesterday. I had Yates convinced that something terrible had happened. Remember when you texted me, you asked me to look into who Joni married?"
I nodded.
"That was the ticket. You knew it, didn't you? Deep down?"
I shake my head.
"I don't know what I knew. I didn't think she was married to Henry. I couldn't shake the feeling that it was all connected. I had no idea how, though.
I'm just so tired. All I want to do is sleep."
The doctor comes in and Cash gracefully waits in the hall. I'm pushed and prodded, latex gloves examine my mouth, my throat, my eyes. My vitals are monitored. Oxygen, heart rate, blood pressure, muscle function. The doctor pulls a chair up to the bed, tenses his fingers under his chin, asks me if I have any questions. I don't. Then he talks. Through him, I learn all the things that Henry did to me. He'd kept me barely conscious for more than 15 days on a mixture of Dilaudid and Benadryl, a narcotic injection. They'd found oxycodone and hydrocodone in my blood, as well as a drug called midazolam, a highly potent sedation drug primarily used for its amnesic properties. I wasn't likely to recover many memories from my 2-week ordeal at Fishing Lake.
How did Henry get all these drugs? Don't hospitals control this kind of thing?
I am angry, demanding, slapping the hospital mattress with my palm. The doctor is kind and apologetic. Men with money, it seems, can obtain almost anything they'd like. I, of all people, know how easy it can be to find narcotics on the street. I shudder to think of the drugs in my veins, cut with God knows what. I think of Henry's collection of prescription pain medication. Henry, who knew my history, my past. My only external injuries are the stitches in my foot from running through the woods and my left wrist where Henry's handcuffs sheared the skin. I have matching scars now, thin lines on the top of each wrist, a physical reminder of what I've been through. Literal scratches on the surface, I suspect. Yates follows closely on the heels of the doctor and takes her place by my bedside. She tells me about their investigation, a formality because of Henry's death. They are trying to trace the root of the drugs. As much as Yates can figure, Henry solved the crime of Tara's murder when the police could not. He admitted as much to me. He tracked me down, planning to kill me out of revenge. But the idea that he could have Tara back, a stand-in who looked just like her, was too tantalizing. Who cared if we were different people? He could simply turn me into her. He'd nearly succeeded. I remember his relentless pursuit, his almost overwhelming attraction. I question myself, really. Only someone desperate for love wouldn't recognize the insincerity in it. He'd proposed after 4 months. He'd never felt love for me. Obsession? Yes. Hatred and blame? Yes. But love? Yates thinks a man like Henry is incapable of love. Sometimes I still dream of his hands. I wake up disgusted with myself. A few days later, Yates brings a criminal psychologist to the hospital who can explain Henry. He is a behemoth of a man, folded into one of the hospital chairs, dwarfing it like a piece of dollhouse furniture. He tugs on his beard as he talks, his thick fingers combing the edges of the wiry hair, and I watch, fascinated. It doesn't make sense to me that Henry would go through all the pains of trying to run me over. Break into his own house? For what? It makes no sense, I protest, helpless and weak, sinking back onto the pile of pillows behind me.
It makes perfect sense, Dr. Reginald taps a pen against his notepad. All your talk about finding Caroline, this pushed him over the edge. Did you ever walk an unruly dog, Miss Whittaker?
I'm sorry?
When you walk a dog that isn't trained, it wanders. The longer the leash, the more erratic it becomes, sniffing here, crossing in front of you, tripping you up, darting after cars. But when reined in, it'll walk straight and with purpose. It can still be unruly on a short leash, but it won't. It's psychological. A short leash sends a message.
I'm the dog here. I am numb, tired.
Yes, unfortunately, you are. I'm sorry.
He coughs briefly, then recovers.
To him, you were spinning out of control. If he could rein you in, he could resume the role of protector. He knew your past. Why not just simply use it? If you're scared for your life, you're not gallivanting the countryside looking for your biological mother. If you find her, there's a good chance his secret comes out. It was all distraction. And then, when you rebelled, there was rage. Do you understand why?
I shake my head, no.
Sociopaths are coldly, almost blindly, logical. He'd never think twice about plowing down an intersection full of people if it accomplishes his goal. They care about one thing and one thing only, their objective, their agenda. His goal was to replace his beloved Tara.
Was he capable of love?
Tara was his obsession, someone well below his station in life whom he could easily manipulate, someone happy to be isolated, or at least compliant.
Tara was so compliant. You are defiant, unlovable. I wonder if my sister knew she was being manipulated, and remember her poem to Henry. A subtle, coded, thumbed nose gesture, almost assertive in the knowledge that he wouldn't get it. Could it have been her first step in breaking free? Maybe. So, it was all an attempt to control me, keeping me under his thumb. Dr. Reginald nods.
There is endless psychological research on evil people, but in my experience, the average sociopath has no idea they are wrong. They're born this way, not made.
As for Mick, Henry wasn't lying. There was another trial, one I hadn't known about, where Mick testified against Jared Pritchett and then later implicated men several rungs higher than Jared, in both drug and sex trafficking, in exchange for a lesser sentence. He never went to prison. Jared was out in 5 years, thanks to overcrowding laws and some kind of a deal. The reason Jared tracked me down and inadvertently killed Tara is unclear. Revenge of some kind. They're looking into it. Following all leads, I'm assured. Jared killed Tara, Henry killed him, I killed Henry. There was a circle of life feel to the whole thing, but it left an acrid burn in the back of my throat if I thought about it. Mick, on the other hand, never had a knack for catching the right break, always a half-beat behind, lagging in the wake of the wave. That he'd eventually succumbed to drugs didn't surprise me. That he ended up testifying against Jared did. There is still one remaining mystery. Tara had been living in New York City with a controlling man who refused to call her by the name her family had used her whole life, Joni. He called it low class, blue collar. I could see him saying this with a slightly curled lip, a subtle roll of his eyes, that dismissive wrist flick. Tara had been borderline agoraphobic, unable to work, ridden with such anxiety that she had to take a myriad of medications just to control it. Or at least, she thought she did. I suspect Henry simply liked his women medicated. In Henry's room, they found a bottle of Dexedrine, a medication for treating hyperactivity disorder known to cause paralyzing anxiety in patients who did not have ADD. The prescription was for 40 pills. There were 7 left. Yates tracked down Maslow, and he filled in a few blanks. Tara had found him through the public records 6 months or so before she was killed. According to Maslow, Tara called him, begged him for information on Hillary Lawler. He refused, but the call always nagged at him. Truthfully, he said, I always nagged at him. My story. Everything that had happened and how it all went down. He hated how I left town, didn't trust him to do his job. He lost sleep wondering if I'd survived. He checked up on Jared and Mick. As long as they were in their rightful places, he left well enough alone. He was retired, as it was, gave sunset sail tours off the coast of North Carolina. When he was invited to a wedding in the city, he called Tara back, agreed to meet her. He could never shake that call, he'd said. Not that he knew a whole hell of a lot, but he was drawn to her because of me. He said he nearly fell over when he met her at a diner. She looked so much like me, he thought she was me. He told her what little he knew about me. My name was likely Zoe. I'd told him that before I left. I was headed east, as far away from San Francisco as possible. He still had my note. Bright lights, big city. He suspected New York, but didn't have a lot to go on to back it up. As much as I can figure, shortly after that, the feature in New York Magazine ran with that silly group shot at Le Fleur de Lis. It would have been a lot of luck, I suppose. But a sister might recognize a sister, no matter how small the face. The idea that Joan was there that day looking for me wakes me up at night, panicked and profoundly sad. I brought all of this to her. Me. All of this was my fault. Likely Jared had been watching me for a while, waiting for the right time to make his move. By sheer chance, he'd followed through on the wrong sister. She was killed only a half dozen blocks up from the flower shop where I was working that day. She was alone, contrary to Henry's story. He hadn't been with his wife, going out to dinner, married 1 minute, the next, not. It was all a ruse, a ploy, specifically tailored for me. It's all a theory, and mine alone, so Yates tells me. It all seems so serendipitous, except whatever the exact horrible opposite of serendipity is. I actually went so far as to look it up once. Zemblanity, that's the word, coined by William Boyd. It means unpleasant unsurprise, which doesn't seem quite terrible enough. I caused my sister's death, and the whole resulting chain reaction led to Henry's almost 2-year-long psychotic break and his eventual death. There were buckets and tracks and pulley systems in place, but I was the moving piece that set it all off. Sometimes I imagine an alternate universe, the idea that I could have stumbled on her by chance, fetching Elisa a ribbon the exact color cornflower blue as the latest batch of hydrangeas. No, not that one. Try again. That shop uptown? Maybe we'd order the same thing at the coffee shop? Extra whipped cream, extra caramel. She'd be so happy she finally found me. I'd be shocked she existed at all. I imagine showing her Elisa's and my apartment with Lydia. I imagine a friendship with her, someone I can be myself with, whoever that may be. I imagine I'd never married Henry at all. It's a nice little fantasy, and I allow myself the indulgence. Then, sometimes, very late at night, I have to nip the bud of happiness that threatens to bloom at the idea that anyone was looking for me at all. I realize it makes no sense. In the daytime, I'm gutted by the whole thing. My fault, I wail to therapists and doctors. I'm not acting. I feel these things. But at night, alone, sometimes my mind wanders. My sister wanting to meet me. Scouring the city, her anxiety-ridden heart hammering at all the noise and the traffic and the subway. She braved that for me. For a second, if I let it, my heart swells a bit at this. This whole time, I'd had a tether, some invisible thread linking me to someone else. I just never knew it. Zoe? I blink my eyes open, startled awake. I'd been dreaming, but it flits away faster than I can catch it. Penny stands at the foot of my bed, her purse hugged tightly across her middle. Her eyes twitch from the window to the door and back to my bed. I struggle to sit up. Penny. My mouth is dry and cottony. She moves to my bedside and refills my water cup. The pitcher wobbles in her hand. Thank you. The chair scrapes the tile floor as she pulls it closer to the bedside. Will you be all right? She half whispers. I'm sorry. You saved my life. I stare at her face, willing her gaze to settle just for a moment. She fidgets, her hands smoothing her pants, rifling through her purse. I reach out, touch her hand, and for a second, she stills. Did you know I was there? At that house? She shakes her head, vehement. No, no, Zoe, I didn't. He fired me. It's all my fault he got away with all of this. She takes a gulp of air like a half sob. You've known. Of course she has. I hadn't thought of it until this very moment, but Penny knew Tara, Joni. The shock of seeing me for the first time then. A flood of half-overheard conversations rush back. Henry, but it isn't right. It doesn't look proper. The way she couldn't look at me, never said my name. How much did you know? That we were twins? She nods slowly, for once, leveling her gaze. She clears her throat. When she speaks, for the first time her voice is clear and steady. Frank and I lived in that cabin behind the Whittakers' property. Surprise must register on my face because she halts and coughs, a resonant wet sound from deep within her chest. Henry grew up at Fishing Lake. They bought it from the Vizzinis. Frank and I worked for the Whittakers for years. I knew much of this, that Penny worked for Henry's family, that the Fishing Lake house was Henry's parents. I close my eyes, smooth my eyebrows with my index finger. I wave my hand around for her to continue. In the back, at the edge of the property, used to sit a guest house, much like the one you saw. It was almost an apartment, really. I tended the Whittakers' house, affairs, bills, and social calendar, and Frank was an accountant at Mr. Whittaker's law firm. Mrs. Whittaker was in advertising. They were nice people. They just had one very troubled, teenaged son. She rummages in her purse, pulls out a tissue, and dabs her eyes. I remember then, a fire, and I know what's coming before she says it. She shakes her head. I saw the smoke from the upstairs bedroom. I came running down the lane. Frank was in the house. He'd been sick with shingles. By the time I got to our walk, Henry was there, just sitting on a rock, watching it burn. I screamed at him, told him Frank was in there, that he was trapped. But it was like he didn't even hear me, or didn't care. He just watched it burn, mesmerized. Plump tears fall down her cheeks one after the other, and she blots them as they drip off her chin while she speaks. By the time Frank knew there was a fire, he'd tried to come down the stairs. They collapsed underneath him. His spinal cord was severed. She pauses, pours herself a drink of water from my pitcher into a fresh styrofoam cup. The Whittakers were traumatized. They took Henry to every psychologist in the tri-state area. They were good people. They kept me on until they died. Could never apologize enough. Never pay for enough. Rebuilt a house for us, bigger, on another patch of property, farther down the trail. The one you found. Said we could live the rest of our days there, rent-free. Henry wasn't allowed back there as a teenager. How did they die? I set my cup down on the nightstand, shocked to realize that I don't know. God, there was so much I didn't know. I can almost see Henry, the flame alight in his eyes. I imagine his barely there smile. I recognize it. A car accident? Some kind of brake malfunction? I've always wondered. Out in the hall, an alarm sounds and a clatter of orderlies and nurses rush by with a gurney. We both turn our heads to watch. When it returns to silence, she continues. Then there was Tara. And as an adult, he always claimed that fire was an accident and he was in shock. But I saw his face that day. He was gleeful. All that light reflected in his eyes, it was like Christmas to him. Her voice hardens, takes a sharp edge. Well, anyway, he was charming as an adult. He brought me back, apologized again and again, paid me more than I had any right to take for what work he gave me. She studied the tile floor. I needed the money. Frank's disability benefits were dwindling. All we had was Social Security. And then Henry got married, and Tara was so wonderful, so quiet, polite, respectful, a delight. And then she died. And he comes home 3 years later with you. Zoe, believe me. She says and leans forward, pulling my hand into hers, her palms cold and her nails digging into my wrists. I didn't mean for any of this to happen. I tried to ask him about it. He told me to mind my own business. I told him that it just wasn't right, that you didn't know. He said he was going to tell you, but he was in love with you and thought you'd leave him. That he deceived you. He swore he just stumbled on you one day. That you had done the flowers for a company event. I nodded. That's true, but he set it up that way. He found me. Knew it was all, my voice cracks, a lie. He said he was captivated by you, by your spirit. He can be very convincing. Could be, I mean. Her mouth twists and I see this for what it is, a confessional. Penny feels guilt for accepting me at face value, for not questioning it. I remembered overheard conversations, Penny's voice. It just doesn't look proper, Henry. Oh, God. How didn't you know I was there? Didn't you come back? I press, needing all the puzzle pieces with newfound urgency. She shook her head. He fired me. He was unraveling, I think. He called me a liability. The last day I worked for him is the day he brought you back to Fishing Lake. He asked me to clean the house, set up a spread. I did that. He said you were sick, that you'd been threatened. I begged him to tell you who he was, who your sister was. He screamed at me to mind my own business, told me to go home. So I did. She folds up her tear-dampened tissue into a neat little square and tucks it back into the pocket of her purse. I did come back, once. It was evening. He was sitting on the back deck drinking a glass of brandy. He said you'd left him. Gone back to the city, stolen some of his money, you were furious about Tara. He blamed me, he was angry as hell. She shakes her head a quick snap like a self-admonishment. I'm afraid of my own shadow most days. Henry Whittaker scared the living daylights out of me. I touch her hand. I forgive you, Penny. And I'm forever thankful. She stands up, waves her hand in my direction, and turns to leave. At the door, she pauses and turns back. I have nightmares about that fire. Do you know, a week prior to that, I had caught him cutting off the tail of one of the neighbor's farm cats with a hacksaw? I told his mother. She retrieves the tissue from her purse, blots her chin and cheeks. I always thought that fire was retribution. Frank is paralyzed because I snitched on Henry. Oh, Penny, I say softly. I was scared, Zoe. She stands in the doorway, backlit by the bright hall lights, looking diminutive, a hunched, rounded figure. I spent years looking over my shoulder. I considered telling you about Tara myself, but I always stopped to wonder, what would he have done to me? Epilogue. 6 months later. It was Lydia's idea. In fact, she made all the calls, talked to all the right people. I come home from the care office one day. She's running circles around me like an excited puppy. She grabs my hand, leads me into the living room, and sits me down on the couch, her hands flat on my shoulders. Please don't be mad, okay? We've moved in together, a different apartment in Hoboken, bigger, more luxurious. Warm and rich colors, browns and oranges. Decorating it has been a form of therapy. I'm a rich woman now. New York is an intestate succession state, which means that because Henry died without an updated will, as his current wife, I inherited everything. All his liquid assets, his apartments, his stocks and bonds. I'm sure he never counted on that. His will was hopelessly outdated, still named Tara as his sole heir. I won't be mad. This is also unlike Lydia, who generally has one lukewarm mood, forever perfecting her bored face. She's giddy, pushing her palms against her knees, starting and stopping sentences until I finally say, "Oh God, just say it," out of frustration. I found Evelyn. She takes a deep breath, her hands grasping mine. The state pays to cremate unclaimed bodies, but the funeral homes don't always do anything with the remains, in case anyone ever wants them. I shake my head. Nothing about that made sense. I remember that spastic little estate lawyer and his tiny closet office. He said they disposed of her ashes. What? You're crazy, Lydia. Evelyn died more than 5 years ago. Anyway, they said that wasn't true. Most funeral homes' policy is a few weeks. I talked to a lawyer at the time. It doesn't matter. I talked to the funeral home director. He said he has metal boxes in his basement from the 70s. They can't bring themselves to dispose of them, although they have every legal right to do so. He said most funeral homes have a basement full of ashes. Which is so sad when you think about it. But Zoe, her eyes were shining, bright blue. They have one labeled Evelyn Lawler. My heart stops. Time itself stops. The idea that I could go back, fix the worst thing I ever did? I can't even wrap my head around it. There has to be a mistake. I don't even know what funeral home she was sent to. I just called every funeral parlor in the Bay Area. It wasn't that difficult. I think it was maybe the 11th one I called. She scrunches up her face, eyes to the ceiling in thought, then shrugs. It doesn't matter. The point is, she's there. She extends a piece of notebook paper with a name, address, and telephone number. Howie Funeral Service. I stare at it. I could have a memorial for Evelyn. My mom, the only one I've ever known. I could think about her without this hollow, empty feeling in my stomach.
Would you come with me? I ask softly.
Of course. Lydia hugs me, her metal bangle bracelets clattering against the back of my neck. My hair is short again, some kind of emotional protest. Truthfully, I miss the length. I've become someone else yet again, although Dr. Thorpe, my psychologist, agrees this is what should happen. I can never be my pre-Henry self, but Henry has changed who I would have become. She assures me that this is what life is, a sum of experiences, that I cannot grieve for the woman who may have existed had Henry not come into my life, or rather if I had not let him in. She assures me that I will be whole again, that a person cannot simply vanish because of one traumatic year. I'm convinced I have. She assures me that I will heal. And that is, for now, enough. I am not without my scars. I have wretched nightmares, night terrors, really, where I'm asleep but am wandering the house, screaming, terrified, sweating, until Lydia finds me trying to cut off imaginary plastic handcuffs with pinking shears from the kitchen. I'd be terrified to live alone. I went to the dentist not that long ago and had a panic attack at the sight of the Novocaine needle. Yes, there are remnants. Dr. Thorpe, whom I see 3, sometimes 4 times a week, says I have post-traumatic stress disorder, which is often medically treated with antidepressants. Since I won't take any medication, we use a combination of hypnosis and cognitive therapy. And I do think it's helping. It's hard to say. I don't make a move lately without consulting Dr. Thorpe, caught once again in this limbo between the person I was and the person I might be should I ever find my way back to her. Most of my sessions revolve around 2 topics, Evelyn and Henry. I have guilt about Evelyn, of course. My issues with Henry are layered and complex. Sometimes in the early morning space between sleep and consciousness, I miss him. I miss his vacation hair and his large, capable hands. I miss the way he took charge, dealt with complications for me. Money and finances, bank issues, insurance. I'm grieving for the Henry I thought I knew. I'm grieving for the caretaker I've lost. Then I alternate between self-loathing and frustration. When I tell her about Evelyn, she clucks her tongue once and says, "Zoe, I think that'd be lovely." Dr. Thorpe is the kind of person who uses the word lovely freely, usually in combination with the word simply. She's also the kind of person who wears slacks and blouses. Her burgundy acrylic nails tap rhythmically on her notebook. Her teeth are capped and her gold hoop earrings glimmer as she shakes her head. "Do you think the plane will be hard?" I ask her. If she says yes, I'll have a panic attack. The people. Ironically, I have a hard time with crowds. I see Henry's face or Jared's, and sometimes I shake so bad I can't see. My teeth clatter and my vision swims. "Do you think the plane will be hard?" She drums her pen against her watch, a subtle time-is-almost-up signal. I don't know what to say. Lake Tahoe in the fall is a rainbow of colors, the leaves a shock of red and yellow against the cerulean blue of the lake. The air is crisp and clean, and our New York lungs are a little shocked from it, high, like we've been sucking pure oxygen. The canoe bobs and wheezes in the water, aimless. The weight of all 3 of us may be too much for it. Lydia pulls her life jacket around her, checking and rechecking buckles. Cash eyes me, wary and nervous. Sometimes I catch him looking at me when he's not wary, not nervous. And all I see is love. In those moments, I can see myself loving him back. One day. For now, I mostly feel guilt that he's fallen for someone so ruined. Most of the time I'm a fragile bird to him. He is gentle and scared and loving and skittish. I don't know when it happened, when he fell in love with me. Somewhere between the diner and the hospital room. One day, I'd like to ask him. He paddles us out to the middle of the lake until the shore is a simple, hazy line on the horizon, white sand and yellow trees, the lights of our resort glittering in the sunset. Evelyn would have loved this place. Oh, the money! I imagine her in my ornate room with the plush carpeting, the high-rise view of the lake from our wooden balcony, the large looming gas fireplace that comes to life with the flick of a button. She'd dance around barefoot, scrunching the deep pile between her toes. Her smile, lipstick on her teeth, the dimple in her right cheek. Her weathered hands with large knuckles, working hands but painted nails. How she'd touch her nose when she laughed. The way she'd tie her hair in a knot at the base of her neck. Before we rowed out to the middle of the lake, I'd dragged Lydia and Cash around on a goose chase in our rented car. Up a private drive on the north shore of Tahoe Vista until Lydia had gasped. "This is the house we stayed at, the one Evelyn got from a friend or something." I stared at the sleek gray lines of the cabin and realized she never could have afforded anything like this. No one she knew could have. Where did it come from? The images come to me unbidden. Thick, juicy steaks on the pink side of gray just about to expire. This house, the glass front, the breathtaking views I neither noticed nor appreciated as a teenager. The beaded dresses she'd bring home and try on, and we'd parade around our small living room, only to have it, poof, disappear the next day. The borrowed convertible. The wind in her hair. In the passenger seat, while Cash and Lydia watched me warily, I started laughing. I laughed so hard until tears squeezed out my eyes. Cash touched my shoulder. "It was stolen," I hiccuped out. "She stole it all." Lydia gave a soft, "Ah, Zoe," like she was about to console me, but I waved her away. "She so badly wanted to live the life she saw every day. She tried to give it to me. With vacations and dresses and steaks and wine and, oh God." My voice was strangled, and the pain in my stomach was so hot white in that moment I doubled over. I imagined Evelyn sliding the keys to Mr. Miska's Tahoe cabin into her purse, the last second before her shift ended, on a weekend she knew he'd be away. I envisioned her saying, "Of course I'll get that dress dry cleaned." Or slipping the slightly slimy paper-wrapped ribeyes into her bag. I think of these things as I lift the lid to the wooden box. All the memories of Evelyn mix and mingle in my mind. She becomes ageless and timeless, and less like a real once-living person, and more like an amalgam of childhood memories. Evelyn, floating free. A breeze picks up, and I gently turn the box over, scattering her dust into the water. At first it coats the surface, then slowly sinks. I think that now, the last thing I ever did for her was out of love. I hope she will never feel unloved again. I can't take back the last 5 years, Ev. And I know you always said sorry was for sissies. You didn't do apologies. You forgave without being asked. Well, I'm asking. I try to track each speck until it all disperses and I can no longer see anything at all. Mingle amongst the rich, I think. She'd always wanted to. The water is calm and sparkling. We sit a while longer, till the sun fully sets, the blue lake turning an inky black. Lydia hums Amazing Grace, and I tell one story, a simple one. My favorite story of my mother. The one that shows who she was as a person. The day she brought Rachel home for dinner. "Sometimes it's the people who have the least that give the most," Lydia says, which is the most perfect thing to say. I think that it's just about as fine a memorial service as a person could ask for. "Ready?" I ask them, and they both nod. They're so patient with me, my friends. As it turns out, I am not, as Henry said, unlovable. Cash paddles us back. Lydia makes a joke about him sinking the canoe, and Cash lightly splashes her with water. I try to pinpoint my feelings. Content. I feel content. As Evelyn would say, well, I'll be. Sometimes life gives you a third chance. Who knew?
The Vanishing Year was written by Kate Moretti and read by Madeline Mabee. Editing and post-production by Common Mode, Paul Fowley, Technical Director. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. The Vanishing Year is available in print from Atria.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.